Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And insurance agent Dan Williamson of Bill Resch Insurance, offering comprehensive auto, business, and home coverage in affiliation with Pekin Insurance. Beyond the expected. More at 812-336-6838. From WFIU, I'm Kate Young, and this is Earth Eats. It's locust blossom season. Look up, they're in the trees, and we have a recipe for them. We'll also talk to two farmers from a collective in Puerto Rico based in agroecology. And we hear about a kimchi startup in Durham, North Carolina called The Spicy Hermit. That's all coming up on Earth Eats, so stay with us. Alex Chambers is away this week. Renee Reed has our news. Welcome, Renee.
Thanks, Kate. I've got two stories for you. The first one is about eggs. Washington State signed a bill into law last week phasing out eggs that are not cage-free. The measure is similar to a law passed in California in 2018 and has been touted as a step forward for animal welfare and food safety. The rules would eliminate battery cages, which immobilize birds in tiny cages, causing distress and injury to the animals. But a close look at the language of the bill shows that the egg industry had a big influence on the bill's passage. The two bills use definitions of cage-free, drafted by the industry group United Egg Producers in 2017. The standards require at least 1 square foot of space per laying hen, room to roam around and do normal chicken things like spreading wings, nesting, scratching, and bathing in dust. Animal welfare advocates say so-called cage-free methods are still not good for the health of the birds. An investigation from the New Food Economy website found that a key lobbyist who pushed the Washington legislation was paid by a trade group called Food Northwest, which represents egg farmers and other producers in the state. Consumers have pressured egg producers to reform their animal welfare practices and have shown that they will pay premium prices for products that are raised humanely. In 1920, there were nearly 1 million African American farmers. Today, there are only 45,000, according to recently released census data from the USDA. So where did all the black farmers go? And how do we restore black farm ownership in the United States? A report issued last month by the Center for American Progress aims to answer just that. The new report shows government-sanctioned discrimination against black farmers dating back to just after the Civil War, including discriminatory agricultural policies in the New Deal and throughout the decades since, carried out by the USDA. It also outlines policies that can reverse that discrimination, including establishing a public land trust for beginning farmers of color, expanding access to land and legal aid, and protecting heirs' property rights. As the report points out, the 2018 Farm Bill seems to be a step in the right direction in implementing these policies. The bill includes provisions to aid heirs' property owners in accessing programs and loans through the USDA by making it easier for farmers to prove ownership. It also includes increased funding for historically black land-grant universities. The new report calls out the need for continued commitment at the federal level to ensure these policies endure and new ones are implemented. Thanks to Taylor Killow and Chad Bouchard for those stories.
And thank you, Renee Reed.
My pleasure, Kate.
Well, it's spring in southern Indiana, and this is Chef Daniel Lort, Farm Bloomington Restaurant. Today, Kate and I are going to be playing with some black locust flour.
We're talking about a fragrant and lacy flower cluster that drips off the branches of the black locust tree in May here in southern Indiana.
They come out for a couple weeks of the year, usually mid-May, and the whole countryside smells of this kind of wonderful sweetness. The aroma reminds me of a Rhine wine, a sweet almost maybe a Concord grape.
If you're wondering how to identify a locust tree, just look up. They're the tall trees, the ones with the dark bark, and they're covered in shimmering white flowers. They're easy to spot this time of year because most of the other trees have already leafed out. The blossoms are edible. The syrupy aroma suggests a sweet application, but I have seen recipes that treat the blossom more like those of a pea plant and use them in savory dishes such as a summer pea soup. In the past, I've made locust blossom fritters, which basically amounts to a funnel cake with flowers in them. I've also candied them by painting each blossom with sugar water and letting them crystallize into a lovely decoration for, say, a cupcake. Not the most practical approach. Chef Daniel Orr says he uses them for edible garnishes on salads in the restaurant. He also makes a white wine locust blossom jelly, and he's going to show us how it's done. The first step is to locate some low branches on a black locust tree and harvest some flowers.
What I do is I go up and I cut off a couple tall branches, and then I pull the flowers off. You aren't going to wash these, because if you wash them, you're going to wash away all that aroma. They're very delicate. Combine the 4 cups of packed black locust flowers with 2 cups of dry white wine and 1 cup of water. And you're going to bring that to a boil, and you're going to let that sit overnight, and it's going to steep and make a tea. Then you're going to squeeze out those flowers through a cheesecloth or through a very fine strainer. So it's basically you've made a tea, and you're going to carefully pour that tea, after you've strained it, off, because the pollen and any little impurities will stay at the bottom of that juice. Then you're going to mix it with 4 tablespoons lemon juice, 1 box sure gel, bring to a boil, and then you're going to add 4 cups of sugar. Once you bring that sugar to a boil, you're going to let it boil very rapidly for 1 minute. Then you're going to have your sterilized jars ready. You're going to put a couple of those locust flowers in your jars and ladle over that syrup. And then what I like to do is I turn the jars upside down, so then the flowers aren't floating on the top of the jar. Once it sits up, then I turn it back over, and then the flowers are kind of left floating throughout the jelly. If you want to keep these shelf stable, you'll need to follow your basic canning procedures with your hot water and boil. Otherwise, you can keep this in the fridge for about a month. This jelly is very, very delicate. It's great on scones. I also like to serve it with melon. I like to serve it with fresh berries. It's good on ice cream. You can glaze different things with it. I also took a bunch of these and I put them in my dehydrator, and I dehydrated them, and I'll use them for making my own tea blends.
Chef served the locust blossom jelly with warm biscuits.
These are some of my great-grandma Wolf's buttermilk biscuits from Gibson County, Indiana. 4th generation.
Absolutely delightful. Delicate and floral. But don't take my word for it. Break off a few clusters of black locust blossom for yourself and try this recipe. But don't delay. These blossoms will be gone in the blink of an eye. We'll post photos of the flowers, the jelly, and of course, the recipe. All on our website, eartheats.org. Production support comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent providing customized financial services for individuals, businesses, and disabled adults, including tax planning, bill paying, and estate services. More at personalfinancialservices.net. Bill Brown at Griffey Creek Studio, architectural design and consulting for residential, commercial, and community projects. Sustainable, energy positive, and resilient design for a rapidly changing world. Bill at griffeycreek.studio. And Charles Schwab and Company, Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Starting a food business takes a lot of different kinds of work. product development, sourcing ingredients, building a customer base, and of course, choosing a hard-to-forget name. Josephine McRobbie caught up with an entrepreneur who goes by the name The Spicy Hermit.
The Durham Farmers Market is home to a lot of eye-catching booths, filled with crusty loaves of bread, plump strawberries, and pillowy heads of butter lettuces. But the Spicy Hermit stand is especially intriguing. Flanked by two large coolers and a display of free samples in white cardboard cups, it's as much science lab as it is produce stand.
And here it goes. Crunchy. Ooh, a little spicy and hot. But it has great flavor. It has a little bit of a, how can I say, a little bit of a twang.
Tangy, spicy, flavorful. It's kimchi, the Korean condiment with a history dating back to around 37 BC. Is made by salting and fermenting vegetables, often using garlic, ginger, or Korean chili peppers for additional flavor. Eunice Chang is the chef behind the Spicy Hermit's kimchis. She advises market goers on which batch to try, green garlic, sweet onion, or the traditional favorite of Napa cabbage.
The Napa kimchi is the spiciest, it's the hottest, but it's also our most popular.
If they didn't grow up with kimchi, visitors to Eunice's booth are often curious as to how to use this little jar of preserved vegetables. It's great to up the ante of an already spicy creation like salsa or ramen. And when mixed with a fat, the sour and pungent taste of kimchi creates something entirely new and complex.
Personally, I like to mix it with avocado and mix an almondy avocado toast.
Avocado toast might not need a recipe, but cards at the booth include step-by-step instructions for dishes like goat cheese and kimchi ravioli or kimchi queso. Eunice's partner Brian is often involved in taste testing these creations.
So those are typically things that, like, on a Sunday afternoon, you know, after the market, we've had time to take a rest, then we'll think about what to cook on Sunday, and she'll usually think up some kind of crazy kimchi inclusive recipe.
And resting after the market is much needed. Eunice flies solo at the relaxed Wednesday market, but on the weekends, the Spicy Hermit is a busy team affair with friends like Cheryl pitching in.
I am Cheryl, and I am a kimchi cheerleader. I eat kimchi. I tell everybody that kimchi spices up their life and makes everything they cook better.
Eunice has fostered a community around her passion for foods. We happen to live in the same neighborhood, and I realized once we met that she was the force behind our local park's delicious but mysterious food truck rodeo. She slings kimchi-infused dishes at local arts and food events, and she inspires her friends to be more adventurous in their tastes.
I never knew I liked kimchi until I tried Eunice's kimchi.
Meredith Emmett is a neighbor of Eunice's. Eunice is deaf, and she chose to write out some of her longer answers for this piece and to have Meredith read them for her.
That's one. Seeming much shorter.
Eunice started making kimchi because she couldn't find any in the area that she liked. She sourced her ingredients at the downtown farmer's market.
One day, a farmer asked me why I was taking copious amounts of Napa cabbage and radish, and I said I was making kimchi. His face brightened up, and he said that he loved kimchi. So I said I'd bring him a jar. Well, he finished the jar in a week, or less, he claims, and he eventually convinced me that I should sell it.
She cites a number of books as inspiring the Spicy Hermit, like the novel Free Food for Millionaires by Min Jin Lee, and Never Home Alone, biologist Rob Dunn's love letter to microbes. She also had a potent memory of her own grandmother's recipe.
She's long gone now. But the only time I saw her make kimchi was when she visited us in the United States. She'd use the vegetables available to us here and then convert them to kimchi. For example, she made green cabbage and cucumber kimchi. I haven't been able to replicate it, but my green cabbage kimchi is definitely inspired by her.
Foods from around North Carolina are central to the Spicy Hermit's portfolio of products.
As for southern staples like collards and sweet potato, these are vegetables that grow easily and abundantly here in the South, and there are many recipes that involve using them with spicy, slightly sour flavors. Think cider vinegar and hot sauce for collards.
So the first step is finding some great core ingredients to use. And there's a very special ingredient, or essence, or activator. It's called han flavor, or sunmat in Korean.
Every person has a unique composition of beneficial microbes on their hands. And when you make kimchi, or sourdough bread, you pass on that composition. So yes, every person's kimchi is different. And yes, some people can just make things taste better.
As the fermenting kimchi sits in a jar at room temperature for a week or two, the flavors of the ingredients and their texture begin to change radically.
So for example, a lot of people don't like raw radishes or turnips, but when you ferment them into kimchi, they become sweeter, with a tinge of sour, and it's almost like a completely different vegetable.
When Eunice was starting to jar and sell her products, she needed to come up with a name, and the Spicy Hermit fit her mission perfectly.
Korea used to be called the Hermit Kingdom, so I took the word hermit, and a friend suggested the adjective spicy, which can literally mean using spices, or it could also mean sassy. Since I'm strong-minded in my opinions, particularly that of food, and I'm a bit of an introvert, the Spicy Hermit seemed to be a very good way to describe myself. Although I also liked the mystery about it. A hermit practicing food alchemy in a cave to produce rather delicious results.
We start to meet to get together to find a way to do farming together in 2015. In 2017, in May, that we made the agreements and everything, so we are just getting there. And then in September, the hurricane just came. And we received first Irma, and after 2 weeks, we received Maria.
Marisa Reyes-Diaz is one of the founding members of Huaquia.
Huaquia, Colectivo Agroecológico, or Agroecology Collective. Huaquia means our, or us, in Taíno language, that is from our native Indians of the island.
Huaquia is a farming collective in Puerto Rico based around the principles of agroecology. Marisa Reyes-Diaz and Stephanie Muzarate-Torres recently visited the Indiana University Food Institute to talk about their project.
We are an agroecology collective, so we are farming, trying to imitate nature and how it works. Agriculture is already a really invasive way to do how we eat, but in agroecology we try to just imitate in the earth, but as well it has to have a social connection, social integrated with the agroecology project. So we knew we had to have some sort of social component to our project. So we're going to farm, and the community will eventually see we're growing stuff, and they'll come to us because it looks pretty, so they'll come. But after the hurricane, people didn't need that much food as help for first response. So our project kind of went towards just building community. A lot of people just needed to tell their experiences after the hurricane. So we just sort of went towards what felt right, basically, which it was helping the community and other communities and other farmers helping in their farms. Because we didn't have, barely had 3 months in the farm. So now, last December, is that we really started to grow food, finally.
That was Stephanie. Marisa and Stephanie took an agroecology course together, which ended up being the spark for their collective.
In the workshops, we took the agroecology course. We were 30 people going together into some small plot and building it into a food garden, into a food forest. And it just seemed kind of nuts to do it alone after the workshop was done. And it's for us, agroecology is not just farming or the community as well. There's a lot of social injustice that the agroecology movement stands up for, or is the first response as well.
Marisa noted that most of the food that's being produced in Puerto Rico using sustainable agriculture is going to restaurants because that's where the money is. At Huaquia, they plan to produce food for restaurants and for CSAs, but also to make the food accessible to the people living in the community close to the farm.
So the idea is not just to produce food is to produce for everybody,
And for us as well. We need to eat.
So the main industry in that area is tourism. So there's more restaurants and hotels and things like that.
Yeah. More hotels, more restaurants that are not accessible for Puerto Ricans, or obviously low income Puerto Ricans. That's the majority of what we have near our farm. We're in the north part of the island. It's about 10 minutes from the beach, but it's a low income community, but it's not a low income municipality. Yeah. If you know, like, we have a lot of resorts, a lot of tourism, but it's not such of a paradise for Puerto Ricans who live there. So we have low income communities. After the hurricane, they were one of the last ones that got their light, the last ones that got their streets clean, the last one that got water.
After the hurricane, and after helping with the immediate needs of the community, Waqia got the word out about their collective using social media. There were organizations in the U.S. looking to offer direct assistance to everyday Puerto Ricans. And one of the brigades working with Waqia was organized by Science for the People.
And they just went to the farm. We stayed in the farm for 10 days, and we don't have electricity or water. So we were camping, a lot of people. We were 15 people camping in the farm, so it was a lot. But we did a lot. Like, at the end of the week, we were like, oh, my God, this looks totally different from when it started. And we were able to do a festival, raise some funds, raise the awareness that we are there in the community. So the brigades have been awesome.
So did you need to clear a lot of things from the land?
We had to clean a lot. We had refrigerators, beds, cars, you name it. We had cleaned before the hurricane, but then after a hurricane, it got, again, out of hand because everybody was just trying to throw everything away.
I was imagining like a lot of brush and vegetation that you'd have to clear. But
also we have that because the grass is
6 feet high and it's like a bambooish grass. So it's really, when you try to cut it, it just, the machete comes back to you.
So in addition to the brigades and other volunteer groups, they hired nearby farmers with equipment to help clear the land.
So you have cleared some beds or some rows now. Yeah. And what do you have growing at the moment?
We have banana, plantain, cassava, beans. We get some corn, papaya, ginger, turmeric, shallots, tomatoes, sweet pepper,
zucchini.
I don't know how to name the gandules in English. It's like a
type of bean,
but different. It's a very good one.
Yeah. It's dried and cooked, like in rice. It's really for Christmas. It's we eat like arroz con gandules, rice and gandules.
And we make the rice. It's the best part of the Christmas thing, yeah.
What kind of seasonings?
We made a sofrito that is a mix of onion, garlic, sweet pepper, pepper, no one, salt, oil, cilantrillo, cilantro. And that's all. We just put it in a blender and we have the sofrito and we use that to cook.
We use that not only for Christmas, but that's our like base. That's the base for every dinner. Yeah. Sofrito. Amazing.
The Waqia Collective has also maintained and nurtured the connections with the surrounding community.
One of the workshops that we made in the community was a compost workshop. We invite them to separate everything that is trash of the fruits, organic. And we pass every Friday, we pass by the houses and we collect all this organic matter that they separate to do a compost, community compost in the farm.
It's kind of like a competition for them too. Yeah. Like, ooh, who's having more compost or something like that. Yeah. And so they're eating better because they want to eat fresh foods now. They don't have that much smell from the trash in their house. They spend less in their trash bags. Yeah. And then they feel like they're part of something bigger, that they're helping the island, they're helping the reconstruction of the island. And we have some exchange with them. We give them fresh compost for their plants, or we give them some tomatoes. Like, it's a really good, it's a compost program with the community. It's really good. It's going along great.
Future plans for the farm include the installation of solar panels for electricity, a sustainable water source, buildings and infrastructure, and strengthening connections with the community. They also hope to find ways to make the farm sustainable financially so that the five members of the collective don't need to hold down two or three additional jobs to stay afloat.
You know, Puerto Rico is a colony of the United States, so just things that could put you into context of why is it that we're doing what we're doing and why is it so hard. So basically, we can't vote for the president. We only have our representative in Congress, and he also can't vote. He only has a voice, so it's nothing.
Stephanie also brought up the Jones Act and what it means for Puerto Ricans in terms of their dependence on the United States. Though Puerto Rico's tropical climate makes it suitable for year-round farming, the island currently imports 80% of its food, mostly from the United States.
All the peasants, all the people that do agriculture in Puerto Rico, they just get out from the farms and to work in industry and factories because was the industrialization moment. So we lose a connection with the land. That's why we get so big percent of importations. And we are returning to the land.
Farming in Puerto Rico, just farming, it's such a resistance, it's so powerful. If we have food, we have food security, and we are getting out of the system. So it has kind of all the things in it.
We need at least sovereignty in our food, and then we can construct or build something different from the island. But we have to start with the food because it's a freedom for us, I think.
That was Marisa Reyes-Diaz and Stephanie Muzerati-Torres of Huaquia Agroecological Collective. Check our website for more information, eartheats.org. That's all we have time for today. Thanks for tuning in to Earth Eats. Thanks also to the Earth Eats team, including Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Josephine McRobbie, Daniel Orr, Renee Reed, the IU Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Marisa Reyes-Diaz, Stephanie Muzerati-Torres, Eunice Chang, Brian Owen, Cheryl Mitchell-Olds, and Meredith Emmett. Earth Eats theme music is composed by Aaron Toby and performed by Aaron and Matt Toby. Our executive producer is John Bailey. I'm Kate Young, and I produce the show. We'll be back next week. Production support comes from insurance agent Dan Williamson of Bill Resch Insurance, offering comprehensive auto, business, and home coverage in affiliation with Pekin Insurance. Beyond the expected. More at 812-336-6838. Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. And Bill Brown at Griffey Creek Studio, architectural design and consulting for residential, commercial, and community projects. Sustainable, energy-positive, and resilient design for a rapidly changing world. Bill at griffeycreek.studio.